Hello, welcome to Slightly Foxed and the long-awaited arrival of spring. We have a 20th century story of new beginnings for you today, littered with colour and beauty and very appropriate for the season, I think. Now, as usual, Gail Perkis, one of the two Slightly Foxed editors, is joining us from her home in Devon, far, far away from Cambridge, where I'm sitting at my desk. Hi, Gail. I bet it's gorgeous down there right now, isn't it?
It is. The hawthorn is out. The bluebells are poking through the floor of the woods. Such a relief after the winter.
Two other foxes with us today. Stephanie Allen in Sussex.
Hello.
Urbanista Anna Kirk is, as always, in London. It must be really perky up now that things are starting to open again.
Yes, definitely. I mean, on the way into work, there's a bit more hustle and bustle. It's not just display windows left untouched for weeks and weeks.
Yes.
You know, there's a bit more movement. It definitely has a different feel. It's much less eerie than it was in past months.
So I know you and Steph have been calling around the bookshops, haven't you, because it's quarter day. How is that? How are they all feeling about things now?
I think very relieved and very happy to be actually in the shop and being able to welcome in browsing customers. It's a very different experience to shopping online. If you're in a bookshop, you just happen upon things. And I think that's where the marketing element comes into it, and people just want to fill their shelves and fill their windows that now actually can lure people in.
It's so true, isn't it? Because even if you go into a bookshop for one book, I don't know about you, but I always come out with four or five because it's impulse purchases, so it must really have hit them.
We call regularly every quarter. We have about 70, and Anna deals with the overseas shops. And it's been obviously an incredibly difficult time for them. But all of those who've stayed in business are really excited about opening up, and they're starting to take a really wide range of stock. So we've had a really positive feedback from a number of shops, looking forward to events, particularly a couple of times a year. We go to independent bookshops and meet subscribers around the country. And I'm sure that lots of our listeners are keen to get back into their favourite bookshops. And if they can't, then there is the organisation bookshop.org, an online company who've been set up in direct competition to Amazon with the aim of supporting independent bookshops. You can order from them, nominate your favourite shop, and they will receive 30% commission from that sale if you nominate a shop. If you don't, you can just order from them, and then 10% of commission will be shared among the independent bookshops who are affiliated with bookshop.org.
They've now had over £1 million worth of sales, and there's a huge number of bookshops on there, so you can easily find one that's local to you to nominate.
I mean, are they matching Amazon for speed?
Oh, yeah. Well, unless you do Amazon Prime, you know, within a couple of days. You know, quite often there's a nice handwritten note inside. I can't fault them.
And you've been nominating One Tree Books, haven't you, Gail?
Yes, I have. We've got very few bookshops around here, sadly. And as I was brought up near Petersfield, I thought I'd give my custom to them.
Thanks, everyone. On to today's guest, Laura Freeman, an art historian, journalist and writer. She's here to tell us about a man who straddled the art and literary worlds, Jim Eade, born in 1895. An artist, he went on to become part of Lady Ottoline Morell's famous writer's circle in Bloomsbury, and later to create Kettle's Yard. That's the groundbreaking art gallery concept in Cambridge. It laid the foundations for the idea that art should be for everyone, by being established in three derelict cottages in a poor part of Cambridge. He turned it into a light, bright, accessible but domestic space, very different to the imposing art galleries that were very much the norm at the time. Welcome, Laura.
Hello.
Thanks very much for joining us today. And I'm fascinated to hear about Jim Eade. How did you first come across him?
Well, I was a history of art undergraduate at Magdalen, which is the college that's really just down the hill from Kettle's Yard. And my fellow fresher art historian who had grown up near Cambridge said, you know, there's this absolutely wonderful place and it's only a few steps away, shall we go? And we went in Freshers' Week. I mean, I think neither of us being much for drinking or parties or bonding events. And she rather wonderfully said to me, I won't tell you very much about it because I want it to be a surprise and I want you to discover it for yourself. So we stood on the doorstep and we rang the bell and we were welcomed in, and we were the only two there that afternoon. And it is just a magical, slightly uncanny place.
It is. It's not at all what you'd think an art gallery would be. We'll talk a bit more about what it physically looks like later. But that began your interest in Jim Eade, the man who founded it?
Yeah, well, certainly I fell in love with a couple of the artists in the house that day, you know, people like David Jones, for example. Then a couple of years ago, Kettle's Yard had been closed for a major refurbishment, and I was sent by the Sunday Times to cover the reopening. And I had this brilliant tour by the architect and the director, Andrew Nairn. I was searching at the time for what I wanted to write, you know, a second book about. And I sent Andrew Nairn an almost one-line email saying, is anyone writing a biography of Jim Eade? And if not, can I?
So he was a Welshman, wasn't he?
Yes, he was born in Penarth to rather strict Methodist parents. His father was a solicitor and his mother was the daughter of a Wesleyan minister. High Victorians and deeply conventional. And Jim never really was the child they quite expected. He had an older brother who was an absolutely model older son and followed his father into the legal profession, lived a couple of doors down from his parents all his life. And Jim was very, very different. And I think often felt that he was struggling to break away from what had been a rather restrictive upbringing.
So how did he set foot in the art world in his early days? He went to school in Cambridge, I think, didn't he? Is that right?
Yes. He had a rather kind of unhappy and unsatisfactory school career. He dropped out of two different schools and seemed to have had age 15, a sort of, I mean, I suppose we call it a nervous breakdown, but effectively said to his parents, I can't go back to school. And he managed to persuade them to send him to art school. So he went to an art school in Cornwall and then up to Edinburgh. He always said all his life, you know, I so wanted to be an artist and I so had to admit that I wasn't really one. And some of his paintings do survive and they're a bit Cezanne-ish and they're a bit brackish.
Well, he was a young man, wasn't he?
He was a very young man, but clearly, I mean, you compare the sort of works that Ben Nicholson is producing at 19 and that Jim is producing at 19. Jim had a wonderful eye, but, you know, he wasn't a brilliant artist. And I think what happened was he made his homes his canvas and created a masterpiece, ultimately, in Kettle's Yard.
Yeah, it's a tough realisation, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then, of course, everything's interrupted by the First War, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he served in France.
Yeah, and he had this added complication that in Edinburgh he'd fallen in love with a fellow art student called Helen, whose parents were German. And he said it was very difficult signing up because my best friend was a German and how could I go off and fight them?
Yeah.
He did sign up. And so this rather sensitive, slender young man sent off to France where it was for him, as for every other young man, a living hell.
And he was gassed, wasn't he, and invalided out?
Yeah, he was gassed and also seems to have had, I mean, people talk about, you know, trench stomach and trench fever and sort of terrible gastric troubles. And there's this amazing description in one of his letters of his being taken to a military hospital after he's been in the trenches. And he remembered, you know, all his life, the white sheets and the white nurse's uniform and the whitewashed walls and this sense of, I think, cleanliness and safety and serenity. And I just wonder how much that this played into his desire all his life for order and beautiful spaces. I think clearly it became a kind of symbol for him of salvation almost after
the chaos. Yes, the mud and the chaos.
Yeah.
So he's demobbed.
Yes.
And then he went to become assistant curator at what we'd now think of as the Tate Milbank in London. But it wasn't called that then, was it?
So it was the National Gallery Milbank, which was sort of the sister institution to the National Gallery at Trafalgar Square. He calls himself a photographer's boy. And I think what he was really doing was cataloguing all the photographs of works of art in the collection, which was an incredible education in itself, because essentially it was a sort of history of Western art in photographic form. So having not had much of a conventional education, he was one for teaching himself. He was a huge reader and a great studier of pictures and postcards. And, you know, I think he felt it was a great privilege to be able to walk through the galleries of the National Gallery and have all those paintings to himself out of office hours.
And presumably in that world, he is then starting to actually meet the artists of the day as well.
Yes, it's funny. I think the impression some people take away from Kettle's Yard is this rather sort of monk-like figure, this hermit in his kind of beautiful cell. But particularly as a young man, he was such fun. He was such a dandy. He loved parties. He admits to having what he calls a rather dukey phase, where I think he sort of rather courted aristocrats. But he also liked a literary lion or lioness as well. And he was rather in the thrall of Lady Ottoline Morel and used to go to her her tea parties at Gower Street. There are some fabulous photos in the National Portrait Gallery archive of sort of Jim and W.B. Yeats just having tea with the railings behind them. And he met all the Bloomsbury set, you know, the David Garnetts and the Duncan Grants and the Vanessa Bells, and invited them in his turn to his house on Elm Row in Hampstead. And he started having these literary teas as well. But I think he saw Lady Ottoline Morell as a sort of a mentor and fairy godmother even.
Well, which indeed she was to many artistic and literary people, wasn't she?
Yeah, and he tells this wonderful story that she came up to Hampstead, and Hampstead has a fair on the Heath every year, and he took her in the dusk to the fair, and they rode the carousel, and you know she used to wear these extraordinary layers and layers of ropes of pearls, and he said, well, they were riding the carousel and all was merry, and he heard a sort of squeal, and he looked back and she'd fallen off her horse and was lying on the base of the carousel with this horse sort of repeatedly trampling her breast and her pearls sort of in disarray. And she took it very well afterwards. And he said she looked like a figure in a kind of Uccello painting or in a tapestry, you know, with this heraldic figure fallen under her horse. But see, he always had this amazing eye for almost seeing similarities between pictures and real life. I think it's almost as if there was no distinction. You know, he talks about seeing two herons once in St. James's Park, and he said they'd flown straight out of a Mantegna painting.
You mentioned that he fell in love with Helen. They got married, didn't they, Laura? When was that? After the war?
Yes. They married very soon after the war. Despite having German parentage, she was very Scotch and forthright. Jim always said, well, she was very good at saying to him stuff and nonsense at his more fanciful ideas. And she was a great reader as well, and also a wonderful musician. She played the piano beautifully. And she was a great knitter. When I met her daughter, Mary, who is still alive, I met her when she was 94, and Mary had this fabulous knitted iPad cover, and she said, oh well, actually my mother knitted it as a tea cosy and I've just kept it for years and years. But I think Helen kept Jim in check. I think he was rather prone to flights of fancy, and I think sometimes she helped to bring him back to earth.
And what a contrast with Ottoline Morell, because I discovered that her great-great-uncle was the Duke of Wellington, which was a rather surprising connection. Yeah. But she had innumerable lovers, didn't she? Bertrand Russell and Roger Fry, Augustus John.
George Bernard Shaw, have I got that wrong?
Quite possibly.
Strange choice.
So I think she and her husband, Philip, who was a Liberal MP, had a very open marriage and gave her space to cultivate painters and poets. Mm. In fact, their house in Oxfordshire became a refuge, didn't it, during the
Garsington.
First World War? Yes, for Duncan Grant and Clive Bell and Lytton Strachey.
Yeah.
And Sassoon as well, I believe.
They all mocked her subsequently. She was sort of caricatured in novels by Huxley.
Yeah.
But actually, I think she must have been an extraordinary woman. A very tragic end. She developed cancer of the jaw and had to have her lower teeth and her part of her jaw removed. But I always feel that people were unkind because she must have been a very generous spirit.
Well, she was much caricatured. And actually, there's one line I found that Jim, when he's writing about her, says, I learned to do quite a good impression of her. And my goodness, I felt guilty every time I did it. Mm.
There's a very good biography of her, actually, by Miranda Seymour, which I recommend for anybody who wants to read more about her.
I think the other thing that's quite intriguing is, I mean, I think her taste was quite different to Jim's, and I think she liked some of those kind of rich Amiga workshop colours, and she liked quite heavy Chippendale as well. And that really wasn't Jim's thing, but he clearly found the homes and the ambiance and the atmosphere she created extremely attractive.
She was an oddity, wasn't she? Because she was a deeply religious woman as well, wasn't she? Which, I think, having read a bit more about her, informed her entire life in a very unfashionable way in that circle. Mm. And also, oddly, she seems to have lived in a very affluent way with these literary salons and circles in Bloomsbury and at Garsington. But as it turned out, they had very little money. Mm. She went bankrupt, didn't she, later in life?
They certainly had financial difficulties, yes.
The other name that comes to my mind at this time is Eddie Marsh, Laura. Mm. Tell us a bit about him.
Eddie Marsh was this incredible, almost handmaiden to poets. He was a great supporter of Sigrid Sassoon and Rupert Brooke, and also a supporter of young artists like Christopher Wood, and ultimately, you know, my chap, Jim Eade. And what Marsh would do, I mean, he would adopt people, he would take them up, he would encourage them, he would promote them. I mean, his biographer said he was fantastically diligent about reading manuscripts, and he would, you know, read them, you know, down to the last comma. And he also had a brilliant collection of art. He used to joke, he said, you know, I'm like old Mother Hubbard, I've got so many children, I don't know what to do. His children being his paintings. He said he once read the lease to his tenancy of his flat and it said, you must not put nails in the wall. And of course, there wasn't a wall or a door or a door frame that didn't have a nail in it. So Jim got to know him. I think Marsh was on the Contemporary Arts Society Committee, and Jim at the time when he was a young man was secretary of the Contemporary Arts Society. So that's how they met. And Marsh was instrumental in helping Jim get his first serious book published. It was a biography of the sculptor Henri Gaudier-Breschka, who Marsh had known a little bit as a young man. And when he read Ede's book and he discovered the extent of Gaudier's poverty, when he was, you know, struggling to make it as an artist and living in these sort of miserable studios, and Marsh said to Jim, I just feel so awful. I could have done so much more to help had I known. And he writes to Jim, you know, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa.
And we should point out that Marsh was private secretary to Churchill, wasn't he?
Yes, he had an amazing political career as well as sort of this other life. But yes, a very, very close relationship with Churchill. And I think followed him round various ministries as Churchill sort of, you know, made his way up.
Yes.
Tell us a bit more about Gaudier-Breschka, because he was a sculptor primarily, wasn't he? And he was killed in the First World War.
Yeah.
And Jim acquired his estate.
Yes, well, here's where the story gets a little bit knotty. And I think this is one thing I'm struggling to write a little bit, because this is the first time in Jim's life where he possibly doesn't do everything entirely above the board. But Gaudier died in the trenches and his estate passed to his partner, mistress, friend, sister, this woman with a strange identity called Sophie Brzeszka. And when she died in Testet, her estate with Gaudier's came to the treasury and it turned up on Jim's office in the Tate. It was sort of dumped there and no one knew who it ought to belong to. And Jim persuaded an artist friend to buy the estate, because Jim couldn't do it as a civil service. And then he bought the estate from this friend, and there were all sorts of shenanigans behind
bit
the
dubious.
Scenes.
Yeah.
I think it was a little bit underhand, let's put it like that. But he saw these works, you know, they were modern, they were strange, they were weird, they were alien. And I think Jim thought, you know, this is something great. And what happened was, not only did Jim came to own all the sculptures and drawings and plaster casts, but also this amazing body of letters between Henri Gaudier and Sophie Brzeszka. And he set about in the late 20s reading these letters and beginning to construct a life of Gaudier. And he wrote this extraordinary book called Savage Messiah, which tells their story, and it's partly directly quoting from the letters. It's partly interviews with people like Eddie Marsh and Enid Bagnold, Horace Brodsky, Ezra Pound. And Ede had a kind of, well, he almost had another nervous breakdown. I think it was a huge labour of love, and he was still working full time at the Tate. And the Gaudier story, I mean, it's sad partly because it came to such an early and tragic end. And Jim always said, and he might not be wrong, that Gaudier could have been the great, great sculptor of the 20th century. I mean, he was only in his early 20s.
Like so many others, yeah.
There's an amazing letter from Gaudier written in the kind of probably the last weeks of his life in France about, you know, he has no sculptural materials and he carves little sculptures out of the handle of his bayonet and, you know, any scrap wood that's lying around. That impulse to create and to make art, even in the midst of destruction.
Mm. I've sometimes thought there's a podcast in itself about the literary and artistic losses in the trenches. When you think about Alain Fournier and all the others, you know, who produced one work or just a handful of work and then were cut down. And he was obviously one of those, wasn't he?
Yeah. And I think, you know, when I said Jim had what seems to be another breakdown while writing the book, I think there was a kind of, it was almost a pile up of events, because there was this very dramatic flooding of the Tate in January 1928 when the Thames burst its banks. And Jim got a call in the middle of the night saying, you better get here. And he arrived to find the basement of the Tate sort of 5 foot deep in water. And he spent several nights, this is January, remember, it's dark, wading through freezing water, trying to rescue Turner watercolours from the basement. And I think the effect of spending all those nights wet and cold and freezing brought back the memory of the trenches. He was also at the time working on the Gaudier book, all the while having in his mind that Gaudier had himself died in France. And I think all these things rather came together to make him collapse, and he had the best part of a year on sick leave.
While he was at the Tate, he must have made contact with an awful lot of contemporary artists. Did he start collecting then?
Yes, he did. He always used to complain to his superiors. He said, well, none of you go and look at modern art. You're just sort of interested in the art of the previous century. And I'm going every night after work to, you know, the little galleries and the selling galleries in the West End. And he met Ben and Winifred Nicholson, David Jones, and he became friends with them, and he did begin buying or collecting or being given their works. And this at a time often when you know, no one would buy a Ben Nicholson work because it was, you know, too modern, too strange. And Jim writes that, you know, he'd often get these paintings, which are now worth hundreds of thousands, if not millions, you know, for the cost of the canvas and frame. Mm. And I think, you know, someone like David Jones, he did become very close friends with, and again, Jones had fought in the First World War. Jones was a Welshman by parentage, and they got on terribly well. And Jim's wife, Helen, said, you know, I've never met a man who needed quite so much looking after as David Jones. Jones used to move into their house in Hampstead for weeks and weeks at a time, and he had his own bedroom, and there were these beautiful drawings that Jones did of the garden at Elm Row with, and you can see in tiny detail of a little Gaudier Breschka sculpture in the garden that was being used as a bird bath.
Wow. So he must have amassed quite a collection.
Yes, and I think he admits that he was a terrible one for cadging. He used to badger and nag, and you know, would you give this and would you lend that, and can I do an IOU and can we do a part exchange? He did often beg and borrow and not quite steal, but you know, he did love to acquire. He was such a magpie. I think sometimes we think of him as a bit of a minimalist because Kettle's Yard is so beautifully done and so precise, but he was always, you know, picking up strange things. And one of his great granddaughters told me that towards the end of his life, when he was living in Edinburgh, he was in his 90s by this point, they walked past a building site and some builder had just got his brush and gone swish, swish, swish across a board, and it had just made this sort of perfect modernist painting, and Jim swooped and picked it up and hung it on the wall at home.
I mean, at this stage, as you were saying, Jim had this terrible period with the flood at the Tate and this period of mental illness, this terrible greyness and dampness. And he changed things, didn't he? He resigned from the Tate and he and Helen went to Tangier.
Exactly. It's extraordinary. He sort of retired at, you know, 40-something. When he had first had that nervous breakdown, he had this year of sick leave in about 1929, and he went to stay with a painter friend, a man called Teddy Wolfe, who had taken a house in Tangier. And the sun and the light and the colours and the warmth were deeply restorative. And over the next 6 or 7 years, he went to Tangier almost every year, clearly really, really took to it. And he always used to say, you know, I'm happiest in a linen suit and barefooted. And so Jim was a great letter writer. And I think it's characteristic that he sort of built a house by post. He hired a manservant and he found a foreman of works. And so he built this house and then handed in his notice. And they moved to Tangier in the later 1930s. It was sort of a white modernist villa, really, up on a hilltop. And I went there last January, and it's a really, really beautiful spot.
So this is, as you say, beautiful, white, simple, modernist house with a huge terrace overlooking this wonderful view. And I know, Anna, you were telling me on the Kettle's Yard website, there's a lot of stuff, isn't there, about the time in Tangier, because this was a huge turning point in Jim and Helen's life.
Yeah, so last summer, Kettle's Yard were running this series, Tangier Dades, following the Eid's time in North Africa. And this really very much fueled the wanderlust. And I'm very jealous of Laura actually being able to visit there, because the series featured so many unpublished photographs of their life out there and of lots of extracts of his writings. And the main source was the manuscript, which was called Variations on a Weekend Theme, which was a handwritten log of the Gibraltar servicemen who went to stay with the Eads each week. These kind of accounts of getting to know all of these guests over these couple of years, 1946 and 47, about their dinners and beach picnics and just conversations.
This is the interesting thing about it, isn't it? Because this, well, Laura, you tell me, but it seemed to me that this laid the foundations of the idea for the Kettle's Yard Gallery, because they turned the house into a kind of restorative haven full of art and music and beauty, and literally altered the house, I believe, didn't they? They added bedrooms to it so they could invite people to come and restore themselves just amidst art and literature.
Yeah. Well, there's a lovely letter from one of the soldiers who came over from the barracks at Gibraltar to stay, and he said, you know, you are called Eid and this is an Eden. And the word Jim uses is the aridity of service life. And I think he had always remembered just how desperate and void the experience of being a soldier had been. You know, no art, no literature, no music, no solace. And he wanted to take these men out of their barracks and give them just a taste of normal life. There's one soldier, for example, who's a piano player, and he says, you know, there's no piano in barracks. I haven't played for, you know, as long as I can remember. And they get him to sit down at Helen's Bechstein and play. And there was one room in the house that was sort of all bookcases. And Jim would just say, you know, if a man was reading a book, we'll take it back with you. It's yours.
Yeah.
And they had these wonderful conversations about James Joyce and Virginia Woolf. You know, Jim really was a great reader and a great book collector. Many of those books are still at Kettle's Yard. I mean, he had thousands. And I think there was this immense generosity of spirit. Helen did all the cooking, of course.
Yes, I was going to say that someone was cooking the meals, weren't they? Yeah. And it probably wasn't Jim.
Well, in the log that Anna mentions, Jim mentions the kind of heroic, triumphant moment when they get a freezer and they can have ice cream. I mean, I do think Helen was a bit of a saint.
How did they afford all this?
I would say Jim's finances remain something of a mystery. This is what I'm still working on. He was often very, very short of money. I think he spent what he had. He gave very generously.
He was lecturing, wasn't he, Laura, in the States?
Well, he had two stints of opening his house. So he first of all started doing teas in Tangier before the war. Then he spent a significant part of the war lecturing in the States, where he was paid for his lectures and he earned money. And he amassed a little bit of a war chest, which he then put towards the project of opening the house after the war to servicemen who were still on Gibraltar, still waiting for leave to come home. But what is very much to his credit is that for a long period in the war, although he was saving a little bit towards the future, he sent huge amounts of money back home to Tangier for Allied war relief. Tangier became a bit of a site for refugees, and Jim gave lectures and it went towards jumpers and clothes and bed linen for people who had lost everything.
So they're in Tangier for a long time, aren't they? It's nearly 20 years, isn't it?
It is, it is. It has been described elsewhere as an exile, and I think I'd like to make the case that I think it's more than that. Jim did a lot of thinking, and as you point out, I think that experience of opening the house to the soldiers, I think, was a stepping stone and a foundation stone to Kettle's Yard.
So perhaps that's the moment we should talk more about that, because I think they had a brief sojourn in France, I think, didn't they? But they found their way back to Cambridge.
Yes.
And bought three slum cottages.
Yes, three slum cottages and another little one over the way. And they really were slums. They were derelict. They were condemned. I think the council wanted rid of them. And it was agreed that Jim could buy them and renovate them. And he and Helen lived for a while on Maid's Causeway in Cambridge, just a couple of rented rooms. And he said he used to go and stand outside these slum cottages before he had been allowed to take possession of them, and he would sort of close his eyes and imagine his furniture, his pictures into those rooms. He would think about what he would do with them. They moved in 1957, and really almost as soon as the paint dried, he started opening the house up from 2 till 4 to undergraduates or anybody else who had taken an interest. And you could come for a tour and tea and talk, and he would show you his collection.
And the best thing about it that I read was that you could actually borrow the pictures.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, marvellously, he would say, well, you know, go up to the attic and have a rummage and take whatever you like. And Jim would sort of fill out a little book and you'd put your name and your college and you could take it away for a term. And there's this anguished round robin letter he used to have to send at the end of every term, chasing works that had not been returned. And I think his line is, when works are not returned, it rather diminishes the pleasure with which they were lent. But, you know, and he did used to lend books, and I've done lots of phone interviews with people who were at Kettle's Yard in the late 50s, 60s and early 70s, and so many people describe the experience of cycling away with a book and a Gaudier Breschka drawing or an Alfred Wallace picture in the bicycle basket.
It's amazing.
And I just kind of love that image of all these sort of works of art being cycled all over Cambridge.
Yeah, with some 18-year-old, you know.
We actually had an article in Slightly Foxed by Mark Hayworth Booth, who was an undergraduate in the 1960s and knew Jim, and he relays how he learned so many different things from Jim, but he specifically learned how delicious marmalade is if produced cold from the fridge and served at tea time. So it's this kind of mix of high and low culture and just the welcoming atmosphere of both Jim and Helen. And he also says that Jim was a regular hospital visitor. He would sit and talk to patients mm-hmm. who had no friends or family visiting them. He just seems like he just loved people, and just art is for everybody. It's very democratizing.
And in fact, he himself went on to become a curator of photography at the V&A, and he helped persuade the University of Cambridge to take over Kettle's Yard.
Well, I'm very grateful to Gail, who pointed me in the direction of Mark's piece, and I then spoke to him, and that set off a kind of lovely daisy chain effect, because Mark kept saying, well, you must talk to my friend so-and-so, who used to go to Kettle's Yard at the same time, and they said, and you must talk to my friend so-and-so. I think it's why is it always worth following these leads, because although many people remember similar things, every single person will remember something slightly different, some little anecdote, some quirk, something that Jim said only to them. Mm. And, you know, all these stories, they do help to bring someone back to life. That's what I'm really hoping to do for readers of this biography.
Kettle's Yard sounds like a wonderful place for people who got to go there and borrow things and have tea. I think perhaps the thing that is most interesting about it is that it entirely changed the idea of what a gallery might be, because these cottages, it's not a posh place. And, you know, if you think about galleries at that time, mm-hmm. big, grand, imposing buildings, the architecture of power, complete reversal of all that. This was very domestic. Yeah. And I think it set a pattern, didn't it? Changed the philosophy, the approach of who and what art is for worldwide. Yeah. I don't think it's overstating it, is it, Laura?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that Kettle's Yard was only for privileged undergraduates at Cambridge colleges, because I think Jim's absolute driving passion was that art was for everyone and beautiful rooms were for everyone. He gave a BBC broadcast very early in his career just about really how to make your home a more pleasant place, you know, letting the light in, you're filling it with beautiful natural objects and plants and pictures. He once invited a group of miners from Ashington to his home in Hampstead to hear madrigals. He struck up a correspondence late in life with a prisoner in a Glasgow jail who had started sculpting. He really believed that however unpleasant your circumstances and surrounding, the art would raise you up. And I think what many people take away from visiting Kettle's Yard is that in these very modest, unassuming cottages, he created this space for art and beauty and light that is such a sanctuary. Sanctuary is the word that has been used again and again in the interviews I've done with people who used to visit Jim at home. And I think the influence of Kettle's Yard has been huge, not just on how visitors think about their own homes, but also about how museums and galleries arrange their rooms. If you think about the National Gallery and the Tate and the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge, they're all classical temple museums with porticos and stone lions and great stone steps up to the marble entrance hall.
Quite excluding, aren't they?
They are. They're meant to impose, and they're sort of meant to be authoritative. And I think that can be brilliant in its own way, and I think it can help you get into your intellectual groove. But there is another approach, which is to say, you know, make a gallery feel homely and domestic and on a more intimate scale. Make it feel that you can settle into the surroundings. You know, the point about Kettle's Yard is you can sit in the chair, you can pick up a book. Certainly in Jim's day, though not now, you could touch. He used to encourage people to touch the finger of the Godier dancer, that very beautiful, slender lady with her finger outstretched. He used to give people the Brancusi, Prometheus head, to hold, because he would say, you need to feel its weight, you need to feel the contours. And I think that idea that art shouldn't only be behind a glass screen or behind a little kind of wire barrier that's alarmed, but that it's something that you can touch and interact with. His grandchildren used to take the Godia Breschka dog to bed with them as a teddy bear. You know, Jim liked works of arts you could carry around in your pocket. He used to take Alfred Wallace pictures in his attaché case on business trips so that he had something to put in his hotel room. It's this sense that art is something that is just absolutely in the warp and weft of life. It's not something that is only visible in a gallery or a museum.
Well, thank you so much, Laura. That was fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
Such an interesting journey to take, and you've guided us beautifully. Thank you.
Thank you.
Laura, will you sit tight and give us a book recommendation?
Yes, of course.
Thank you. Just before we move on, a brief word about Slightly Foxed. Elegant, eclectic, and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Now, Steph, before we get on to recommended reads, you have another book lover's day trip for us, I believe. And this one, it's local to me. It's Heffer's Bookshop.
Yes, Heffer's, the university bookshop in Cambridge. Gail worked at Heffer's for a year after finishing her degree, and I spent my first 2 years in the world of books at Heffer's. I worked for the managing director, John Welsh, and the last Heffer to work there, Nicholas Heffer. It was founded by William Heffer in 1876. His first shop sold stationery and fancy goods. He went into books about 20 years later and forged very strong links with the university. For the next 100 years, Heffer's dominated bookselling in Cambridge with over 5 shops in the city. At one stage, it had a stationer's, a paperback shop, secondhand shop, and a fantastic children's bookshop. And it was a real family firm, with 7 of William Heffer's 9 children working in the firm. His grandsons followed his sons into it, and his great-grandson, Nicholas Heffer, was chairman until he retired in 1999, when it was bought by Blackwell's, which many see as Heffer's Oxford twin.
The main or rival might be a better way of putting it, Steph.
Right, yes, twin or rival. And I think one of the reasons Heffer's was so incredibly successful, it used the phrase known all over the world. And at one stage, they were sending out 60,000 catalogues at a time.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, because all new undergraduates would be offered an account. The catalogues were wonderful, and they were put together by legendary Frank Collison, who was witty, stylish. He was still there when I was at Heffer's, and you'd go into his office, every single bit of wall space was covered in illustrations, cartoons, typesetting examples. It was just fantastic, a real Aladdin's cave. And I think people would have probably paid for his catalogues, let alone the books within them.
It's a bit like Henry Southern, isn't it? The antiquarian bookshop that we've featured on the podcast before. They're wonderful catalogues too.
Yeah.
When I used to work there, I had a glorious 9 months running the Penguin bookshop, which was next door to Fitzbillies, the cake shop. And it only sold Penguins. And this is in the days when really only Penguin produced quality paperbacks. I think Picador was just starting. And I had a wonderful time there because if there was nobody in the shop, then I just sat and read all day. And the only distraction was that whenever Fitzbillies were baking, there was a pipe that seemed to come through at the bottom of the set of bookshelves. And there'd be this wonderful smell of Chelsea buns cooking.
Oh, yes. People who don't know Fitzbillies, it is another Cambridge institution, isn't it? The most fantastic bakery.
I would nip out of the shop, shut the door, lock it, and nip into Fitzbillies to buy a bun and then go back to the shop.
Oh, this sounds pretty good, Gail. It sounds like how work should be.
And the main shop that's still there today, that was purpose-built in 1970. It's now, sadly, the only shop that Heffer's have in Cambridge. But it's cavernous. It's got a sort of labyrinthine basement and a bright upper ground floor with a balcony. And I think anybody who visits Cambridge, you just have to go in there. Just rows and rows of books and fantastically well-informed staff. And I have to name-check a couple who have been there for decades. So Richard Reynolds, he works specifically in crime fiction. And then there is Sarah and Andrew, and they have all supported Slightly Foxed right from the first issue. So thank you.
In that case, definitely name checks all round. It is a marvellous place. It's not the most beautiful bookshop you'll ever go in, but it has got real heart. Thanks, Steph. On to book recommendations. Would you like to start us off?
Yes. Well, I've been using lockdown to try and read a few books that I've always meant to but haven't. And I have only ever read Flaubert's Madame Bovary, so I wanted to read something else. And I found his Three Tales, which was his last great work. It's got rather strong religious themes. The longest tale within it is A Simple Heart, which is the life of Félicité, who is a loyal maidservant, who retains her Catholic faith despite great hardships in her life. It's just a beautiful, very simple tale. It has its humorous moments. Rather strangely, she grows to love a parrot. And when this parrot dies, she has it stuffed. And it's the last thing she sees as she dies, and she believes it's the Holy Spirit. And that parrot actually inspired Julian Barnes to write Flaubert's Parrot, which is going to be my next read.
You're a bit of a French kick at the moment, Steph, because wasn't it Voltaire last time?
Yeah. I'm working through them.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know that one. It's a great recommendation. Thank you. Laura, what have you got up your sleeve for us?
Well, I've actually picked a slightly foxy-themed book. I've chosen David Garnett's Lady into Fox, which is, I have to confess, I've had no trouble reading when it comes to research during lockdown, but actually reading for pleasure, I have found myself occasionally a bit sort of distracted and anxious. So I thought, well, instead of trying to chomp through great 19th century novels, I'm just going to read novellas. And this was kind of one of them. It's very short, it's less than 100 pages. It was published in 1922. And it's the weirdest premise, which is that a man discovers that his wife has been turned into a fox. And what I love about it is it's just kind of presented as a fait accompli. There was a fairy's curse, or she went into an enchanted grove, or someone, put a spell on her. It's as if she sneezed and then it happened.
Okay.
And it's very strange, curious little book. I think the descriptions of fox behaviour are so brilliant. I mean, I think David Garnett must have spent a long time watching a vixen and her cubs outside, his study window or something like that, because he describes so beautifully that sort of foxy behaviour. I really recommend it. The edition I've got, I'm afraid I'm hogging the London Library copy, but it's got woodcuts by Ray Garnett, who was David Garnett's wife at the time, and they're really beautiful and simple, and it's just a very strange, idiosyncratic read.
Well, this is like the perfect moment to point out that next month we're going to be talking about magical realism, I believe.
perfect.
Excellent choice. Thanks very much, Laura. Anna?
Well, actually, along similar lines to Laura, I'm also recommending a novella. So I am recommending Indelicacy by Amina Kane, recently published by Daunt Books. I just haven't really read anything quite like it before. It's a very simple narrative, very sparse chapters. The narrator is Victoria. We only learn her name towards the end, though, and she's a cleaner in an art gallery until she marries a wealthy man. She then leaves the marriage to be alone in the country. That's essentially all the plot. But it's the way that it's told. It's very calm prose, which at first kind of seems quite unsettlingly cool, but then it kind of builds and builds, and it's about this woman who's realising that her main desire is actually to write, and it's kind of, I guess, finding that room of her own and that independence, but in very, very clean, very, very precise prose. Yeah, I found it quite transfixing. And of course, with her working in an art gallery, there's these descriptions of how you experience paintings and you kind of see the world. And she also goes to the ballet, and also about the act of writing. So it's kind of not a manifesto like A Room of One's Own, but more kind of a love letter to art. I think reading it at a time when galleries and theatres are closed it was a bit bittersweet. And it's also quite unusual because it's very timeless. There's references to candles and carriages, but it's an unspecified city, an unspecified time, but feels very modern. It's quite disorientating read, but I would definitely recommend it.
Interesting. Gail?
Well, I've spent the last 2 months in Venice. I've been rereading a lot of Donna Leon's crime novels. Uh-huh. Her very first book was called Death at La Fenice. It was published in 1992. And she, this year, has just released the 30th book in the series called Transient Desires. They are stories about a man called Guido Brunetti, who lives in Venice. He's a Venetian. And he is a policeman. And he works at the Questura. And he's married to Paola, who is a lecturer at the university in English literature, and they have 2 children. And each book follows a crime in the city, touching on all sorts of different aspects of Venetian life. Actually, Venice itself is a character in the book. You literally could follow a map as he journeys from one place to the next. There are wonderful evocations of Venetian food. Paola's a wonderful cook.
I was just going to say, Gail, I've read a few of those. It's all about the food, isn't it?
Yeah, the food is just food delicious. She cooks. But Brunetti he has a terrible boss called Pater, who is a Sicilian and who's vain and arrogant and self-serving. Pater has a sidekick called Lieutenant Scarpa, who's a very dark character. But on the side of good, he has Vianello, his sergeant. And then there's another young policeman called Puccetti. And they are humane, loyal, hardworking, and they basically capture criminals. Some of the books are set in, one book is set on Murano amongst the glassmakers. Another one is set amongst the fishermen on Pellestrino. I think I've read 10 on the trot, and I've now discovered, wow, having sort of lapsed, that actually I'm missing about 10 of the whole series. So I've been doing a lot of trawling on Abe for hardback copies. And it's a journey I intend to continue until I've got to the end.
Has anyone else read any of these?
I've read them. Yeah.
They're really good. And the characters develop. He doesn't always solve the crime, which is, you know, a nice change. I mean, they're a wonderful insight, too, into, you know, Italian society and politics and bureaucracy and a lot of corruption and a lot of unpleasant people. But, you know, he restores your faith in human nature. A great escape during lockdown.
And we're done for this month, at least. Many thanks to Laura Freeman for being with us. Laura, just remind us when your own book is out, or when you hope it will be out.
I'm very much hoping it will be out in November 2022.
Thank you very much. As I said, we'll be back in May when we'll be talking about the writer and poet Angela Carter and the wider genre of magical realism. Do join us for that one. In the meantime, you'll find all the books and writers we mentioned in the show notes. I know I say this every month, but thank you again for all your emails and messages. Everyone at Fox loves reading them. We have a string of intriguing episodes planned for you this year, but if you're burning to hear about a particular lost or forgotten writer or indeed genre, do drop us a line. Foxquarterly.com is the web address where you will find all sorts of good things, including a contact form. Until next month, thanks for listening and for joining us on our regular literary expedition off the beaten track.